Restorative justice is not simply a way of reforming the criminal justice system. It is a way of transforming the entire legal system, our family lives, our conduct in the workplace, and our practice of politics. Its vision is of a holistic change in the way we do justice in the world. So said criminologist John Braithwaite, speaking of a growing worldwide movement called restorative justice. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Restorative justice explores what's needed to heal the harm done to victims and to help offenders take responsibility for their actions in a way that benefits the community. Three guests involved with the restorative justice movement join me today to explore how this approach is being used in Wisconsin prisons. The Reverend Jerry Hancock, former Deputy District Attorney and now Director of the Prison Ministry Project. Jerome Dillard, former incarcerated individual who has spent over a decade working to help prisoners successfully re-enter society. And former Wisconsin Public Radio distinguished broadcaster and beloved host Jean Faraca, who has in her retirement passionately embraced restorative justice as a volunteer. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I use the word former in describing, you know, former this, former that, and you all have somehow come to this area of restorative justice. And I'd like to ask each of you to just give me a little bit of the backstory as to what you were doing and what led you to take on this concept of restorative justice. And let me start with you, Jerome.
Well, I'm a formerly incarcerated citizen who was released from prison in the 1996. And have embarked on this work since 2002. One thing, I look at myself as an ambassador, someone who's formerly incarcerated, who have been in the system and have found my way out to find a certain degree of success in the reentry process and in life itself.
I know you used to work with Voices Beyond Bars and also with the Madison Urban Ministry. Mm-hmm. But what about restorative justice in particular? What does that mean to you?
Well, what I bring to the table as a formerly incarcerated person is someone who've experienced the incarceration and know that there are individuals inside who work hard of changing mindsets, of change, helping individuals set goals, and understanding the harm that was done by the crimes that were committed.
Great. And Jerry, tell us about, or should I say Reverend Hancock?
No, Jerry is fine.
Okay.
Thank you. I think I had an epiphany, really, about restorative justice, and it started with a reflection on a case that I had prosecuted 30 years ago when I was in the district attorney's office, and it involved a murder that happened, for your listeners here in Madison, at the McDonald's on South Park Street. And there were two young men from Fort Atkinson who had come to Madison to buy a mattress at what used to be Crazy TV Lenny's. And they bought the mattress and then went to the McDonald's for dinner. And a group of young African-American kids came into the restaurant. And one of them, a young man named Ramondo Seymour, for some reason had an 18-inch bow hunting arrow that came to a sharp point with three sort of razor blades at the end. And a fight broke out. The N-word may have been used. And as a result of the fight, one of the young men from Fort Atkinson was stabbed by Ramondo Seymour in the back, and the arrow went all the way through and pierced his heart, and he died on the spot. And that case came to me to be prosecuted, and the trial took 3 days. And as I look back on it, I remember that courtroom very well, because on the left side of the courtroom were the victim's family and friends from Fort Atkinson. On the right-hand side of the courtroom were Ramondo Seymour's mother, grandmother, and grandfather. And during the 3 days of that trial, I did not speak to either one of those families. My job was to convict Ramondo Seymour of murder. the families knew nothing about the case, and they were not witnesses, and so I ignored them. And later on, years later, when I thought about that case, I recognized that I had ignored all the harm that was represented in that courtroom. Of course, the family of the victim had lost a son, but Romando Seymour's mother was also losing a son. And the community in Madison on the South Side that had counted on being able to send their kids to McDonald's with a dollar to get a Happy Meal had lost an important community institution. There was just ripples of harm that went out from that event that needed to be recognized and healed. And simply sending Romando Seymour to prison had done nothing to heal that harm. So it's the memory of that event that has motivated me to look for a different way of dealing with the question of justice and harm and what needs to be done to heal all the harm that's caused by crime.
That's quite a powerful image of those two families on the different side of the courtroom. Gene, tell us what led you to restorative justice.
Well, I'd like to pick up on what Jerry just said about the ripples of harm, because at the climax of the restorative justice process, we throw a quilt into the circle, into the center of the circle, that has those ripples in it. And it leads up to a story that is told by a volunteer of how her grandmother was murdered along with two of her best friends. And it is such a powerful story. And it really evokes the sense of the circle, the ripples of harm that keep going out and out and out and out. And it did the same thing to me. It made me realize that crime is never one-on-one, that the consequences are often intergenerational, that they affect the family in its extension, affect the community. And the reason why restorative justice is so powerful is because it brings together all these various, I don't want to say components, because it's people. It's people that it brings together and unites them in this sense of loss. And sometimes it's tragic loss. And it gives us an opportunity to grieve together and also to make resolutions on how to repair the harm. So anyway, the reason I got involved is because I was at church. I go to Holy Wisdom Monastery, and one of our Odyssey graduates, James Morgan, showed up together with several people who represent Moses. Moses is the Dane County, what's the word?
Chapter.
Chapter, thank you. Perfect. Of Wisdom, which is the statewide organization that's working on criminal justice reform. And James, you know, we know him well. He was one of our most brilliant students. Graduated a couple of years ago. Odyssey Project. And he was so eloquent and so personal in his presentation that I was very moved, and I said, I want to get involved. And so that's how I stepped in. And soon after that, I was invited to a graduation ceremony, a restorative graduation ceremony, restorative justice, that took place in New Lisbon. It was fabulous. Former graduates of the restorative justice program were there, as well as their families and the families of the graduates. And it was a celebration. I mean, it was euphoric. And people were so connected to one another in this process. And I really wanted to become a part of it.
Is it a little bit like the truth and reconciliation approach that was used in South Africa, or that you find sort of on a worldwide level?
Absolutely. The truth and reconciliation councils that were established in South Africa after the end of apartheid and when Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa was designed deliberately to be sort of a restorative justice practice. And in that practice, people who had committed crimes, sometimes horrendous crimes, were invited to come forward to reveal those crimes and to listen to the stories of their victims. And if they did that, they would not be prosecuted. So it kind of combines a lot of the elements of restorative justice, which is most importantly taking a wider view of what's necessary to heal harm.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for just a minute, because I think maybe some listeners will be feeling, well, this is just being soft on crime. This is not punishing someone. If you murder someone, why should you sit in a circle of healing with a quilt and so on? Why shouldn't you just be punished and that can serve as a deterrent? What's wrong with the sort of traditional criminal justice punish the offender approach?
Well, in my opinion, we've really gone too far to the left with dealing with crime and punishment. The fact is, there's a ripple effect, and individuals on all sides of the spectrum, the community, the victims, and the perpetrator, are all hurting people. What I've witnessed in some of the restorative justice circles that I've sat in was true healing with these individuals. First of all, we just look at the effect and never look at the cause. And in restorative justice circles, we have an opportunity of really dealing with the all points of it. And many of these individuals have tremendous traumas that never have been addressed. They've been hurt themselves through environmental. There's a word I'm looking for, but also in their homes, and to see that paradigm shift, to see the light bulb go off when they realize the harm that they've caused and the ripple effect of that harm, I think is healing for all parties.
Gene, let me respond to that as a former prosecutor. I have sent lots of people to prison, and lots of people needed to go to prison. The question becomes, how long do people need to stay in prison? And I think the best answer to that is they need to stay in prison until they change. Now, some people would deny that change is even possible. And in fact, in some ways, the public policy in Wisconsin, known as truth in sentencing, in many ways denies even the possibility that people can change. But as a religious person, all religious traditions believe in the possibility of change. And as a Christian, that's pretty fundamental to my belief system, that people can change. So the question becomes, how do people change? And I've become convinced that the most essential element in people changing their lives, whether they're in prison or out of prison, is empathy, and either the restoration or creation of empathy. And once people can recover their empathy, then real change is possible. And once people get to that point, then they deserve a second chance. And restorative justice is one very effective way of restoring empathy. Martin Luther King said, sympathy was feeling sorry for someone. Empathy is feeling sorry with someone. Mm-hmm. And by telling our stories to each other, we can establish that empathy, which is fundamental.
Yeah. The power of story is something that I certainly know firsthand from the work I've done on radio. And I guess the gap that I felt, the void, after retiring, has been filled by the power of the stories I am privy to sitting in a restorative justice circle. And I suppose I've always been a sucker for redemption stories. And as Jerry said, there's you can't help but feel empathy because of the suffering that you witness. And the movement out of isolation, which is something, and guardedness, which is something that I think typifies the prison experience that happens in a restorative justice circle, is very conducive to developing that sense of empathy, that we're all in this together, that there really isn't a big difference between volunteer and perpetrator, that the circle itself is very democratizing and equalizing, and there is a kind of flow that happens in those circles among and between us.
Well, we know in Wisconsin the record is pretty dismal in terms of racial inequities. The number, in particular, of African-American men that are incarcerated disproportionately, also Latino men. How is the use of restorative justice overlapping with approaches to racism?
I think that racial disparity is one of the most pernicious aspects of criminal justice in Wisconsin. In many ways, Wisconsin leads the nation and the world in racial disparity. And in some ways, Dane County leads Wisconsin. And it's not hyperbole to say that if you had a sign that said convicted felons must ride on the back of the bus, those buses would look very much like the buses in Montgomery, Alabama in 1954. So there is real serious inequality in the criminal justice system. Restorative justice tries to deal with that by, as Gene said, democratizing the whole system, giving people a chance to see what really goes on in prison and what people in prison are really like. And that changes their perspective radically. And that's why restorative justice requires both all of the involvement of victims, offenders, and the community to heal the harm. And it's that community involvement with people in prison that we hope can ultimately lead to more systemic change.
Well, I'm going to have each of you take me into prison with you and to actually be part of, in a specific way, what happens in a restorative justice circle when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, and we are talking about restorative justice in Wisconsin. And I have three guests, Gene Faraca, Jerry Hancock, and Jerome Dillard. We've been talking about how this technique of bringing together victims and offenders in the prison system to help them heal and take responsibility is changing what's happening in the prison system. And I wanted to ask Gene if you would take us with you. You're a volunteer now that you've retired from public radio. And I have to say, you got lots of hugs as you came into the studio today. Lots of people really kind of can trace all kinds of changes in their life to listening to a show. Now you're going into the prisons. Tell us what happens in one of these circles. Walk us through it with you.
Well, my very first experience, which so far has been my most profound, was in Oshkosh, in a facility called the Wisconsin Resources Center. And it's slightly different from other situations because this is an institution where prisoners are sent for treatment for mental illness. And there were 10 of us, I think 12 of us to begin with, sitting in a circle in a very stark corridor with solitary confinement cells lining both sides of the corridor. And we're sitting in, you know, chairs in a circle. And the first question which Jerry posed was, who were you? And then the second question in the next week was, who are you now? And so this gave an opportunity for these men to really tell their stories. I'll never forget one young man. He was really young. I mean, he looked so young, he hardly sprouted a beard. And he explained how he was the offspring of two crack cocaine addicted parents. And he'd been bounced around in the foster child system. And he was told all through his life that he would never amount to anything. And at the age of 17, he ends up in prison. He is he can't read or write, but he doesn't want anybody to know that. And he's in solitary almost all the time. And he's acting out. He's full of hormones, 17-year-old guy. And he is shredding his mattress on the ground, on the floor, cement floor of his solitary cell. And the older man who's next to him in the adjoining cell or across the corridor tells him he's got to shape up. He's got to shape up. He can't act out like this. And discovers that he can't read and starts teaching him how to read. And he does it in very much the same way that Malcolm X tells in his autobiography how he learned how to read, word by word, using the dictionary, in prison. And this young man is so full of energy and enthusiasm for the word. Now, mind you, I'm a writer, I'm a poet. I love the word. And he's in love with the word, with words. And now he's working in the library of this prison. And he is so full of ambition for himself, he's still, you can tell that his nervous system has been affected because he twitches a lot. He's holding a ball that he has to massage, he has to knead, but he's working on himself. He is working so hard, and he is so full of aspiration for himself, for his fellows. He has got friends, an older man who is in the same circle.
And why is he in prison? What crime is it that took him there?
We don't know. We're never told that.
So part of what happens when you go in to work with the restorative justice movement is you're not told about the crime?
Let me be a little more direct in answering that question, Emily. We are never told, and we never ask. It would be easy for us to find out by going on the automated record mm-hmm. system that the state keeps. But we deliberately don't do that because we want to encounter these people as they are now, not as they once were. And once we know their background, it inevitably colors the way we encounter them. So we deliberately don't want to know. Now, people may say, well, you're just being naive, you're being manipulated. I've been around a long time and been around a lot of criminals, and I have never felt that I was being manipulated. People come to our program, and they're all volunteers. They come because they want to be there, and they realize that they're going to have to be honest and do some really hard work. So we prefer not to know.
That's interesting, because I was about to – the question came because I was trying to place him or figure out what brought him there, and it's maybe tempting for us to do that. Oh, you're the one who murdered so-and-so. So back to the group that you're in then, and you don't know why he's there.
I just want to mention that Jerry told me about an exhibit that was just at the public library called We Are All Criminals. And it, somehow, whoever organized this thing got people to tell crimes that they committed that they were never discovered and punished for. And even the Pope Francis, acknowledged that he had once stolen a rosary from the dead hands of a friend of his while he was being waked. And he keeps this rosary right under his heart. On his chest,
well,
to remind himself.
On top of his heart.
On top of his heart. To remind himself that he, too, is a criminal. He's a grave robber. And, that's the thing that happens in these circles. Those barriers are broken down. And you begin to relate to people, to inmates, as people. As people with histories, as people with struggles, as people who are really just like you.
But I must be misunderstanding something, because if part of the process is going to be having the person who's committed a crime meet face to face with the victims and families, that's not what that does.
No. It's a surrogate victim. It's a surrogate victim who tells such a powerful story that I can't imagine whatever the crime is, an inmate not being able to identify with that crime. There are two victims, actually.
Yeah. Let me interject here that the kind of gold standard of restorative justice is that kind of one-on-one victim-offender facilitation that oftentimes gets depicted in the media. And that brings together the elements of restorative justice, because those are facilitated by a community member. So you have the community, the victim, and offender doing one-on-one. Those are very hard to orchestrate and require enormous preparation. And we wanted to try and accomplish some of that, which is making people aware of the ripples of harm on both sides. And so we use a surrogate victim, which is a person who has suffered terrible crimes, but not by the men in the circle.
I see. And so this 17-year-old that you were speaking of, what did he hear from the surrogate victims that might have led to his feeling empathy?
I think he heard, as do all of us in the circle, a story of enormous pain and recognition that he himself had caused that kind of pain in someone else's life. And that recognition is – one of my colleagues talks about it, the light of empathy goes on. So in identifying – the surrogate victim with his victim is the critical moment in restorative justice.
But something else happens as well. In the case of this young man, let's call him Daniel, he had these negative messages, imprinted in his psyche. You'll never amount to anything. Nobody cares about you. And the very fact that there are people who represent the community who are sitting in this circle listening to his story proves otherwise. What happens is that inmates develop in this process a sense of self-worth. Emily, mm-hmm. how transformative that can be, because we experience that in the Odyssey Project. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Jerome, you've sort of been on both sides now, literally, of the bars. Tell us about your take on this.
Well, first of all, I want to say I've had the opportunity of being in the circle with Daniel also. And not only did he hear these, but he would, these stories about how he would never amount to anything. but also being treated in a manner that he was nothing and couch surfed most of his life. To see that paradigm shift, the victim's portion of the restorative justice circle, in my opinion, is the most effective with these men in the circle. The empathy, the light goes on, and they realize that it may not be the same crime that they committed, but they realize the harm that was caused. I'm in awe at how these men take in these victims and really, really feel their pain and the ripple effect of how it affected the family and the individual who perpetrated the crime. Now, during my period, we had nothing like restorative justice in the prison system. At the time that I was in, parole commissioner at that time, Jerry Smith, had formed what we call circles of recovery. We didn't have the community members come in, but we did have some staff members, Jerry himself and other staff members who were pretty empathetic sitting in our circles. But that's where I found my aha moment. And it's a story that I often tell, and that is the Red Dot story. And within those, within that circle, there were individuals who were lifers. There were individuals who were in for short periods of time for violent offenses and nonviolent offenses. And there was a lifer who, you know, the camaraderie that grows within that circle and those individuals from sharing themselves and their histories and where they grew up and how they grew up, it's family. We became family. And one evening, I was sitting with a lifer, and we were playing chess, and we see someone come back in who had left prison maybe 3 months ago. And here he is back in prison. And the guy looked at me and said, "You need to prepare yourself for your release before you get out there." And I really didn't understand it at the time, but he challenged me. And he asked me, he said, "I want you to fill out a list, write down everyone you know, regardless of what their lifestyle is, those you hustle with, those you use drugs with, those who were in the underworld lifestyle that you've become so accustomed to." And as I did this, I started to fill that out. I didn't understand the purpose of it, but I just start a couple of pages of names, family members, street names, if I didn't know their real names. And as I took this back to this man, he had been in about 28 years on a life sentence. And as I took this back to him, and I said, "I have that list." And he gave me a red pen, and he said, "I want you to put a red circle or dot by anyone who's you've been indulged in this life." And as I looked at that, I realized that, wow, pretty much everyone I know is jacked up, you know, and a lot of family members. And his statement to me at that time was, "These people can no longer be an option for you, or you will find yourself back in here." And the light bulb went off, and I realized how antisocial I was. And we began to talk about how to build a network of pro-social associates. And that was life-changing for me. I share that story because, you know, we as formerly incarcerated citizens or incarcerated citizens are often left out of the equation of dealing with mass incarceration, of even bringing forth transformation in the lives of those around us. And it was life-changing for me. Just being in that circle.
I want to say something about lifers, because there was one of the men in our circle, in that first circle, was a lifer. And I was so inspired by just the fact that he had self-selected to be a part of this. And he had no motivation, because in Wisconsin, there's no such thing as earning your... If you have a sentence, there's truth in sentencing, you're going to be in prison for the rest of your life, for all practical purposes. Still, he wanted to change. He wanted to change his life. And so he showed up, you know, and fully participated. And that, to me, was very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Let me just build on that for a minute, because I'm often asked, as a minister, how do I bring hope to people in prison? Let me be clear that our restorative justice program is completely non-sectarian. There is no overtly religious component to what we do, and it's open to anyone. But that question is important for anybody who's wants to affect change. How do you bring hope to someone who's doing a life sentence, or who's 18 years old and has gotten a 40-year sentence with no possibility of early release or parole? And the best answer I can give is that hope comes from learning to live a life of integrity in whatever community you're in, whether it's on the outside or inside a maximum security prison. To be able to live a life of integrity is where hope comes from. And I think restorative justice really helps to give guys on the inside that kind of hope. And so that's why we're so, all three of us are so devoted to that.
And one of the goals is to become a lifeguard. It's a metaphor for saving lives. And saving anybody's life who happens to be in trouble, and so that is really an example of what Jerry just mentioned as integrity,
and that sort of speaks to what you're doing now, Jerome, which is to take your experience and then turn it around and help others who are here.
Absolutely.
Now.
Well, first of all, you know, we were talking about racial disparities earlier. And something that I'm witnessing today is they're going in younger and younger, and they're coming out very hopeless because, as Michelle Alexander stated, it's a caste system. The barriers are tremendous when they return to the communities. And turn down after turn down and couch surfing and just not being able to really be a full citizen. A period of a mindset of hopelessness sits upon them. That's why, you know, as an advocate and someone who works hard to try to change the system, I'm dealing with young men who really feel that they're not part of America. They're not Americans. And they dare to dream.
And in a way, they're taken out of the system because they're not able to vote even when they're on returned and on parole and those sorts of things. I'm curious what would bring victims into a system where they're with you in the circle telling their obviously traumatic story. Let's say it's a person who's had a relative murdered and she's part of this circle telling her story. Is it something where that person then finds it therapeutic to try to get something good to come of something bad?
It's beyond therapeutic, Emily. It's incredibly powerful. One of our longtime victim volunteers, who Jean mentioned, whose 86-year-old grandmother and her two friends were carjacked and taken to an abandoned coal field in Pennsylvania. And all three of them were kickboxed to death and buried under a pile of tires.
That's gruesome.
Yeah. And she comes in and tells in great detail how that crime has affected her family. And she makes it very clear that it's in prison where she's found the most receptive audience to her pain. It's where she feels, in some ways, most at home with that story. And being able to tell it to people who will really understand.
I would have thought it would be a victim support group, not speaking to people where she knows they may have done the same to someone else.
The victim, she tried a number of different venues, but by far the most effective for her has been inside the walls. And part of it is a complicated dynamic of people not being able or willing to recognize her pain. She tells one of the many heartbreaking parts of her story is that this happened in a small town in Pennsylvania where her father and grandfather had been lawyers, you know, for generations. And she and her father are walking down the street and people that they've known for years just sort of disappear into doorways because they just don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And during the trial, she and her father were in the courtroom because she wanted to be there to support her father and represent her grandmother, to be a physical presence there. And she talks about going into the courthouse where her father and grandfather had spent their lives and not being offered a seat because people just couldn't deal with it. But in prison, she finds people that understand her story on the deepest level because they have been there, often on the other side of that. But they know, they share a common point of view.
And the aspect of the story that the men are most moved by is the fact that the murderer is on death row in Pennsylvania. And she expresses her relief upon learning that the capital punishment has been outlawed in Pennsylvania. And the men are just mystified, astonished that she would not want this guy to be put to death. And her response to that is, there was too much death already. Mm-hmm.
The story gets even more complex, and the guys begin to understand just how sort of mysterious this all is and how they really need to be there to support her in her story. The man who murdered her grandmother and the two other elderly women, as a young person, he was 38 at the time. When he was 18, he had been awarded the Carnegie Medal for heroism, for rescuing a young child off railroad tracks in front of an oncoming train. So what is it? How do you talk to people about those kinds of lives? Unless people have some deep understanding of what's going on.
And that brings it back to the questions that you said would be asked, who were you and who are you now? We're going to have some final thoughts about restorative justice in Wisconsin's prisons when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and we are talking about restorative justice in Wisconsin prisons with three guests, Jerome Dillard, Jerry Hancock, and Gene Faraca. Jerome, I'm going to start with you and ask you to tell us a little bit more about who you were and what you are now, the questions that get asked in some of these restorative justice circles.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's important. First of all, I want to say that, well, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I had some traumas in my life, and I'll touch on a few of them. First of all, my best friend was shot and died in my arms at 14 years old. And nobody ever asked me anything or talked to me about that. And something just wasn't right about that within my very, to see a young man taken away at that age. Shortly afterwards, I would say 6 months after, I witnessed my girlfriend's mother being shot six times by a boyfriend. And as we tried to get her into the back of a truck to get to the hospital, a man pulled up in a truck and said, we got to get her to a hospital. She died as we were trying to get her to the hospital. Only thing that happened was they came, picked us up, me and my friends who witnessed that, took us down to the police station and said, point him out. We pointed him out. That was it. Take him back. And never got any help with that. Not only those are a couple of things that, I witnessed in my community that I just knew wasn't right. And also in my home, abuse. I had a grandmother who believed in not sparing the rod, actually snitching cords or whatever she could get her hand on. And I was hurting. I was a hurting young man and walking around angry and rebellious. And it led me into crimes that put me in prison. And I spoke about the moment with this lifer, but that was a transforming moment, but also the support that I needed and got when I returned to the community through the faith community with men who were living normal lives and generally caring about my well-being and understand knowing my history as far as incarceration helped me get to some normalcy. And once I got insurance, I got a living wage job and got insurance, I was able to get psychological help for that, which my diagnosis of severe depression, and I was put on meds for a long period of time, and it really helped me kind of stabilize and realize my shortcomings and the anger that I harbored inside. And I worked hard at, being a good husband and a good community member, and have been blessed since.
And so you restored yourself partly by looking back at your own story and figuring out where the anger was coming
and
from.
And with help from others who understood my story
and cared.
Mm-hmm.
Gene, you've been working as a volunteer in the restorative justice program. Before that, you've had decades as a public radio host doing all kinds of programs that involve helping people to see their lives in a new way. What can you take from the restorative justice work and apply it to all of us?
Well, just recently, it was brought home to me how close the identification really is between those of us who are lucky enough to be on the outside and those of us who are inside. I gave a copy of my memoir to one of my colleagues, an associate that's also in the circle.
And this is your award-winning memoir, I Hear Voices. Yes.
And she read it and wrote back to me that the stories I told of my mother and my brother reminded her of the dignity and humanity of the imperfect lives we encounter in prison. And I love that phrase, the dignity and humanity of imperfect lives. Who among us does not have an imperfect life? We just heard from Jerome about some of the traumas he experienced as a young man. we all have struggles and challenges and trauma. It really, I mean, it's what you do with that. It's if you have the opportunity to learn how to reflect and how to rise above, that is the key to whether you get out. And inside, outside, we're all the same.
The phrase restorative justice, I see it now in different contexts, you know, the Y as a program in the school, in the prison. Jerry, as somebody who is directing the prison ministry program, what do you think are the key ingredients for it to really be restorative justice?
You're right, Emily, that restorative justice, that phrase in some ways seems to be everywhere these days. And when you say restorative justice, it's a little bit like saying cheese, that you don't – it tells you something but not a lot about what's really going on. But like cheese, you hope that it has the same basic ingredients, which is bringing victims, offenders, and the community together to yield the harm caused by crime. And that can be – those ingredients can be put together in a number of different ways. The Y has a wonderful program here in Madison. Madison schools are heavily committed to restorative justice, not just to heal the harm caused by crime, but more broadly to heal all kinds of harm, whether it's bullying or other kinds of intimidation, to work through the schools in a very deliberately restorative way to deal with those. So there are a lot of ways of doing restorative justice, and what we do is do those things inside the walls. And I'd just like to say how important the experiences of Jean and Jerome are in a wider sense to criminal justice reform. What's necessary to effectively reform criminal justice is to deal with what I call the politics of fear. So many of our policies are fear-based. People are afraid of others who have committed or have been arrested for committing crimes and want to be protected from those people. And so elected officials can manipulate that fear by saying, if you vote for me, I will keep you safe by locking these people up and throwing away the key. And that's a very effective theme, more effective than saying, I'll see that your kids are well educated or I'll see that you have good health care. Nothing motivates voters more powerfully than fear. And so if we're going to reform criminal justice, we really need to break down that idea. And having people like Jerome in the community saying the kinds of things he says help do that. Because people look at Jerome and say, well, I wouldn't be afraid of him. And then you have people like Gene who go into prison and have these transformative experiences with the men they meet inside the walls. And they come out and tell those stories. And that helps break down the fear.
And I'll just add on, and then we also have people like you who left a career prosecuting people as a deputy, as a DA, took on the faith world, became a minister, and then have devoted your life also to restorative justice. So the three of you actually illustrate different pathways to coming at the sense of healing and trying to do something right here in Wisconsin. I want to thank all three of you for being with me for University of the Year.
Thank you for having
thank
me.
You. Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.